Welcome to Fossils by Firelight, a series of conversations with South Africa's geological legends, where they unearth their discoveries, learnings, memories, interesting stories, and maybe a few tall tales to chronicle our history and inspire the next generation of geological heroes.
Good day. Welcome to another episode of GSSA's Fossils by Firelight podcast series, where we have fireside chats with some of the geological legends and heroes out there. Today's episode, I'm very excited about, we have been trying to get some of these coal legends to come on. Before I start, the reason I'm excited is, a lot of my route into geology involved coal. So firstly, starting off when I was growing up in the southwestern townships, where we'd be on donkey carts delivering coal for the coal-fired stoves, welcome dovers and the likes. And I was always intrigued firstly, where did this come from? How did it form? But then fast forward, my first entry, or rather first work in geology, was as a VAC student, third year and fourth year, was for then ASCs were coal, which then later became Exxaro. And I was quite fortunate at the time to work with some legends in the coal industry at that point. So the likes of the late Ray Petwell Maloka, who worked a lot in the Witbank coal fields, my mentor, and actually my mentor, Dr. Humphrey Mate, and the great Sipho Nkosi, who was the CEO at that time and ultimately became the CEO of Exxaro. And I remember every day I would chat to these gentlemen and had some wise learnings and words and gems that I learned from them. So yes, there's a special place in my heart for coal. Unfortunately, later on, I didn't work on it as much. But I'm excited today that we are lighting up the fire with coal. Just a few thank yous to Nolene, she's normally my co-host, who helped set up and arrange. She couldn't join today, but it's through her hard work that we've got these coal legends around us here. And yeah, thank you to Solid Gold Podcast Studios too, Roswell Wines, for giving us some refreshments. And on to that, I'll start introducing our first guest, the rose amongst the thorns, so to speak, Karen van Deventer, who works for Sugarbush Consultancy, and has quite an interesting path and has worked in, various coal fields within South Africa. Welcome, Karen. And
it's actually great being here, and I've been looking forward to this day. I think my career kind of started first in a laboratory, working with the Council for Geoscience. And I then got offered an opportunity to join the Sasol team in Secunda. So there we started off with exploration. And at some point I said, I want to know what's happening in mining as well, because I don't want to be the person sitting on the other side of the table and everybody tells me, what do you know, because you've never been underground. So I joined the mining team at Twistrai Central and a long time ago, which was to me good fun, and we can discuss all those sort of things a little bit later. And after that, I moved on, became the geology manager, spent some time there, and then I needed some personal changes, and I moved on to Shanduka Resources and moved to Middelburg. On the Xstrata merger with Glencore, we became part of the greater Glencore business. So I worked there in the different coal fields on that side. And then in 2017, I started my own consulting company, which is Sugarbush. The Sugarbush has actually got an interesting story. I needed a company name and an icon that was special to me. And all the sort of typical things that you would find that's geology related was already taken or didn't really have a meaning for me. And we were driving down in the Cape. We were driving past these beautiful sugarbush flowers on the side of the road. And I told my husband, ach, I can it sommer suikerbosie noem, but I guess it'll have to be in English, so it's going to be sugarbush. And when I Googled, it meant hope and a new start. So that's eventually how I got to sugarbush, although it's got nothing to do with geology specific. And then end of last year, I got to a point where as a consultant, clients don't always pay when they're supposed to pay. And I've got kids at varsity. So that sort of made me rethink. And I got an opportunity to join Menar, which meant a more fixed-term income. And I can relax a little bit in terms of worrying where the money is going to come from at the end of the month. And, yeah, I've been there since sort of beginning of December, January, and enjoying the new environment. Working as a consultant, I was a lot alone. And rejoining a company where there's other support and other people to talk to and discuss issues with was quite nice. So that's sort of a rough summary of my journey up until where I am now.
Growing up, I'd heard the word seker boss, and I didn't know the English one until I came across your consulting company. So you're quite right. It would have been nice to use the Afrikaans version, but thank you for sharing that interesting story. Now I'm going to move on to another legend who I was fortunate to work with at some point in my consulting career, Bob Heatherly, of Bob Heatherly and Associates, a consulting company, specializes in various commodities and minerals, but has a lot of coal experience. And that's where I was fortunate to work with Bob Heatherly, who is also quite a swimmer. At times, when I'd call him, he would have just come out of the pool. And that's how he is keeping young.
First of all, Sifiso, I have one question for you. How did you talk me into doing this podcast?
Remember the first attempt was about a year ago, Bob, but I am relentless. Yeah. And as people within the GSA
know,
I like throwing people under the bus. My normal co-host, Nolene, we do that quite a lot. So we did do a bit of convincing, and we do appreciate we're in an interesting country when we're having these discussions, and we really do appreciate your presence. But it's the persistence, Bob.
Okay, all right. Very quickly, I think it was around about early 1980s that I was basically thrown into the coal industry. I was doing base metal exploration for JCI up in the Rustavinte area. We were actually doing exploration for tin. And there was suddenly a big rush to get the Amersfoort coal field drilled and logged and sampled. And I was moved there. And it was something new to me, and I got involved in it quite quickly, and it was great. So I did a lot of my initial coal learning in Amersfoort. Then I ended up back in Rustavinte, back on the base metal exploration. And then there was a big hiatus because at that stage, JCI was restructuring, and I was told, right, you're coming off exploration, you're going to the gold mines. And my first reaction to that was, no, thank you. I don't want to go to the gold mines. I like being in exploration. And I was told, well, sorry, you don't actually have an option. So to cut a long story short, I ended up spending 6 years on the gold mines. Harmony, Bleiferitzig, and Western Areas, South Shaft. And I eventually ended up as chief geologist at Bleiferitzig. And by that stage, I'd had actually enough of it. So I actually left JCI. And we're back to the swimming again. I actually took my whole family off down to Durban and started up a swim teaching school, which I thought was a wonderful idea. And that was going to be my career. But I hadn't done my homework very well. Teaching swimming was not going to actually get bread in the front door. So eventually I went back to trying my hand at consulting, and strangely enough, most of the consulting work that actually started to come my way was actually in coal. So I ended up back in the Ermelo area, and I spent quite a few years as an independent contractor to, funnily enough, JCI again. So that's where I learned most of my hands on, get your hands dirty type of coal work. And one of the guys that led me along that path and actually gave me a hell of a leg up in learning about coal in the field was Dave Proctor. The other guy in the driving seat at that stage was Pat Cochran, and I learned a lot from both of them. So that was my start into consulting, and I did very little other than coal for quite a long while. And that was when I decided that consulting, at least projects that I was getting involved in, was starting to become a little bit big for just myself. So I decided that it was time to bring in some associates. And I thought the best business model was to stick to being an independent, but to bring on associates as and when I needed them. So that was when I started Bob Haverley and Associates, BH&A. And that's now been running. It's still a valid entity. Right at the moment, I am on my own. I don't have any associates helping me with anything. But there have been occasions when I've had three or four associates helping me. So it's been ups and downs. It's been in and out of the coal industry, a bit of work elsewhere, and recently, I've got involved in a lot of training courses, both online and on site, and those I'm actually doing for a training organisation in Australia, and I've actually just come back from a rather arduous trip to Papua New Guinea, where I gave a 2 weeks of training courses at one of the big copper mines. So yes, I've done a couple of on-site courses. I've done several online courses. So I'm actually used to doing what I'm doing right now, which is sitting in front of a computer and seeing myself talking and seeing a whole bunch of other people at the other side listening intently to my lectures.
Before I move on, I mean, you were talking around, you know, the teaching, the training and mentorship. I'll come back to that later on and the whole continuing professional development. But before I deep dive into that, back to the pool, let's dive into that. But you were involved in Olympics in swimming, 72.
Hell, it was over 50 years ago. Yes, I was part of the Rhodesian Olympic team that went to the Munich Olympics. To, again, cut a long story short, because we were in a politically sensitive era at the time, and not many people from other parts of the world actually liked us Rhodesians. We got to Munich, and once we were there, we were actually banned from competing, because the alternative was that the whole of the African Union were all going to boycott the Olympics unless we were thrown out. So yeah, we were thrown under the bus big time there. Anyway, we were in Munich for the 72 Olympics, and that was the one where the Israelis were attacked and massacred by Black September, and that was rather a scary period of a few days when nobody was quite sure who was safe and who wasn't safe, but we just knew that bad things were going on. I sat and watched a lot of the swimming at the Olympics. I watched Mark Spitz breaking 7 world records and earning 7 gold medals. That was actually quite phenomenal. So, I don't want to spend too much more time on that. I've since continued swimming, and I'm now swimming Masters Championships here in South Africa. I've been doing that for about, nearly 30 years now. And in fact, in 2 weeks' time, I'm off to Durban to swim in the 2025 National Championships.
That's how you keep your youthful exuberance. Our next guest is Piet Meyer from PC Consulting. Piet studied at University of Pretoria, started off in Anglo, which he'll tell us a bit more about, and then worked on various coal fields.
Yes, I know everybody around the table. We all colleagues in one way or the other, individual consultants trying to make a living actually. Now that Karen has left, it's only Nico and myself that's left here on this side. The other day we were saying there's nobody else, it's just the two of us. Yeah, so it's interesting. Coal has always been good. I started my first exposure to coal was in 1984 when I was a student with Anglo-American, and they sent me to New Vol for holiday work in December. And at that stage, Anglo was just pre-stripping the soil. They actually did the river diversion, which is the Fall River that we diverted around the pit area. And in that time, we did some in-pit grade control. So it was just preliminary work and for the preparation of a mining for Le Table. Then in my honest years, they invited us to come and see all these fancy great consultants from Anglo, and the guy, Roger Whittaker, who was the consulting geologist for Anglo, which means he was a boss, they called them consultants. At this party, he walked right up to me, he said to me, were you the student that worked at New Vol in 1984? I said to him, yes. He said, I want you. I said, thank you so much. I don't want to go to gold and diamonds because we worked some holidays in underground on the gold mines, and it's not easy. So I started off in 1990, first off with Anglo Coal, but not on the coal fields. So they seconded me to, remember those days, everything was conglomerates. So they seconded me to a measure stone project, which is calcrete exploration in the Lichtenburg area, where all the calcrete occurs and the cement factories are from. And I drilled the very first holes, the very, very first reverse circulation holes of what is today Sephaku. So whenever I drive between Johannesburg and wherever on that highway, and you pass Delmas, you see there's Sephaku packaging factory on your right hand side. I think when I see a cement truck with Sephaku cement on it, then I just say, wow, I drilled that first hole. Took 18 years before the joint venture between Anglo and Sephaku took off. But in June 1992, I actually met my wife during this project, and we got married in Lichtenburg. In June 1992, I was sent back to coal. So then the regional office and the exploration office was in Kriel at the mine itself. There was a backside office from where we worked. And in those days, we were only two exploration geologists. It was Johan Badenhorst and myself. And we did all the Anglo-American exploration. The guys on site, on the mines, did their logging and their exploration. But any additions to their mines, we did the exploration. I drove around 10,000 kilometers a month, chasing holes from Kriel as far as Standerton, New Denmark, all the way to Balfour. We drilled Arnett North, which later became Wonderfontein Mine. I think, Aaron, that's Glencore, and now it's in Bentley that took it over. But we drove quite wide during that time. End of 1994, I left the company and I started my own business drilling. It was during 1996, I think, that I met Karen for the first time in Secunda, and I met Nico. And he was a junior geologist running there in the pit doing gate control for Douglas Colliery. And in the same time, I also did some drilling for JCI, and that's where I met Bob. So we come a long way. Then there was a total downswing of exploration, and the reason why, basically, that your BHP merged with Billiton. No exploration was done. It was a standstill of all capital. And then Anglo-American delisted on the JSE, and they went to London, so no exploration, nothing. So I had no work. So then I joined Total Coal at Dorsfontein and Fosando, which is one of the best things I could ever do, because during that time I actually got exposure to mining and underground mining. And I did a master's degree with a dissertation on the economics of thin seam mining. And that actually gave me quite a lot of insight into underground thin seam mining, although there are no thin seam mines currently. Depends on your definition of thin seam mining. I worked there for 5 years. Then I left. I joined BHP Billiton for 15 months, which was actually some of the worst times of my life, because during that period they were busy with their recovery plan. They flew in Australians. You see this little skin here? It's a skin of a kangaroo. They call it the little Joey. And I like to sit on it because I hate Australians. So that's why it is here, reminding me of my bad days with Australians. And I thought it stopped when I left BHP Billiton, but it didn't stop there. I actually bumped into all the bloody Australians again in Mozambique. So in 2006, I left a BHP Billiton and I joined an Australian company for a year. On a contract basis called the Aquila Resources, and they had all their projects up in Mozambique, Botswana, and then they had iron ore and manganese up in the Northern Cape. So my first exposure to Mozambican coals was in 2006 when we had a big project up there, which eventually became part of Riversdale. Anyways, so I spent about 12 years all in all in Mozambique on and off. There's about not one project in Mozambique that I did not work on or did the initial exploration or did reports on. And in that time, so it was 2007 when I started my own consulting business. So then during that time, I also got exposure to a lot of projects here. Some of those projects are mined out already. Some of them will never be mined. Some of them is coming back again to me. So in that, it's just the consulting business is tough. So it's up and down, as Karen said. Sometimes you get paid, sometimes you wait a lot long for your payment. But I've been in the consulting now for 18 years and on my own business. And I do a lot of work for, again, coming back to the old BHP Billiton for Optimum and Korenfontein. So that's back into my lap, and Nico is doing some of that modeling for me on Optimum, and he did the Korenfontein work, and from there I did the CPRs, and we are working from those resource models still. And then I still have projects, loose projects. I never worked for the big companies in my consultancy. I just can't see that I'll be working for them, because then I could have stayed with them. But it's just a different attitude all in all. So all my clients are small guys. It's normally the guys that can't afford the SRKs, MSAs, and those for the reports. So all my clients are small guys that want their CPRs and want their projects to go ahead. And if you take a lot of small guys and you put them together, then in the end of the day, you've got a lot of work and you produce a lot of reports. I've done 131 CPRs in this past 18 years, which is quite a lot, I think. But anyways, so that's where we are now.
Now, last but not least, our final guest is, you've already mentioned the name, Mr. Nico Denner, who's the director and consulting geologist at GEMEX.
When I started, it was still not BHP Billiton, but actually Ingwe, which came about when Transnatal and Randcoal did a merger. So that was, and I actually left before they became BHP Billiton. So, Piet, maybe I was lucky. but anyway, Sifiso, you said that this is a, you know, the fossil discussion. I hope it's all about coal and not about age. because I think I'm the youngster here between all the other people. And but it's great to be here. Your book, you mentioned that you're doing a lot of teaching, but I'm still learning. And one thing I can tell to the youngsters out there, don't ever think you'll get to a point in your career where you know everything. We learn every day, and especially as a consultant, you're on your own. It's tough, but you keep on learning, and which is great. You know, it stimulates the work environment and the brain and the activity. But I'm also swimming, Bob, but I'm not swimming in the pool. I'm swimming in work at the moment. So we're actually blessed in a way. You know, like Piet said, there's not a lot of – it's only me and him out here. A couple of other guys as well, which is a bit smaller maybe. But it's a tough environment to be a consultant. Piet, you mentioned people paying late, but some actually don't pay. That's a downside for working for small guys. So yes, it's a tough world. And another thing you mentioned is river diversion. You know, they did a river diversion on the Vaal River. Imagine trying to do that today. You can't even divert the small little stream nowadays. You know, it's a whole different ball game. But anyway, back to my career. I actually started off. I was a Genco bursary, and very fortunate after my studies, well, during my studies, we had to do vacation work. So I ended up on the gold mines in the Free State, St. Helena and Beatrix, and spent a year in the manganese fields there at Kuruman, Hotazel area, which was quite fun. I had a caravan in a camp with a couple of boerbokke and two ostriches, and that and a 4x4 with a company petrol cart. So that was my holiday for 3 weeks there in Hotazel, being chased around by the ostriches and having fun there, working in the middle of December out in the field every day when it's 40 degrees outside. So that was tough, but it was fun. You know, as a student, that's probably the best exploration exposure you can get. Then I started off at, which was Ingwe. Well, my first payslip was actually Transnatal, and that changed the next month. And I started there at Blinkpan Colliery and Korenfontein, which Piet mentioned. And by the way, Piet, a lot of those projects you mentioned, I had also some point in time did work on them or the cross paths. You know, it's a small world out here. So I started off there at Blinkpan Korenfontein and did my geology. And at that stage, we were called the geologist in training. So for 3 years, we had a good mentorship program within the company. And you were the geologist in training, and you were paid by head office, not by the mine. So the mine saw you as a bit of a luxury additional skill. They didn't have to cover your cost. And you get exposure, and you work with a mine geologist, and you get training, which was a quite a beautiful system. It's actually a pity that doesn't exist anymore nowadays. And I think I was fortunate to probably one of the last batch of geologists that actually went through that geologist and training program. But anyway, the downside of that was they could move you around as they wish. You know, that actually happened. I was at Korenfontein for probably about 6 months, and I was working for Stoffel van der Merwe and Jannie Marais. You would know them quite well. And Stoffel called me in and said, "Nico, I've got good news and bad news." I said, "Yep." He said, "Well, good news is you're off to Zac." I said, "Zac?" He said, "Yeah, Zulinite Anthracite Colliery." Now, Karen, you would know it's one of Menna's mines. So I started there at Zac in 1995. And And the good news of that story was everybody wanted to work at Zach because Zach is so remote. It's out in the bush. It's close to the coast. And you get extra money. You're like a boss to laugh because you're out there. Okay, so it's good for the pocket to work there. And I said, oh, what's the bad news, Toffel? He said, no, you can leave tomorrow. And that was the kind of notice we got. So off you go, put everything in your car. You didn't have much anyway. It's basically your clothes. You put it in your car and you drove to Zach without Google Maps or anything back then. You know, you had directions and off you went. And then I spent my time on Zach. And that was in 95. And Zach was, you know, it's probably still the best anthracite in the country that we do have. And there was always talks about Zach is going to close down, And as we sit here now, it's 2025 and they're still mining. So it just shows you how things can change. It's like a never-ending story. There's always another bit of gold that they found to mine. But anyway, from Douglas, at that point in time, it was around about 98. The coal prices were not very good. The industry came, you know, things were not looking well. So I got this phone call one day from a geologist. He said, well, my name is Martin. And he said, you don't know me, but I know about you. I said, okay. He said, well, I've got a job for you. I said, well, I'm not in a market at the moment. He said, no, I've got a job for you. I said, where? He said, no, in Rustenburg, on the platinum mines. I said, well, I don't know anything about platinum. He said, no, a friend of yours that worked at, I was an Art Broekhuis, and he worked at Kutala, and he's working here. And he said, no, you're a good guy. We can find you. So I said, well, I've got nothing to lose. So I went for the interview. And 2 months later, I went back to start the job. So I went from coal to platinum, which was a big change. Getting to coal, you know, we were locking borals 30, 40, 50 meters. That's what you're used to. I arrived there, I was working at Lonmin Platinum, and I got there, and my boss said, there's a boral out here. I want you to lock this as part of your training and getting to know the rocks. So we went outside and there was a 1,500 meters of core lying there for me. And Bob, you would probably appreciate this being in the base metal industry yourself. But I looked at that core and it's 1,500 meters of white stuff. I've got no idea. It's all white and gray. Okay? I'm used to black and brown and orange and colors. Yes, and they show you this little chrome stringer. So it's like 2 millimeters. Ah, this is important. You need to look at this. And this is a peroxenite, and this is a norite, and this is olivine, and whatever. And I just said, well, this is overwhelming. But anyway, so that's where I started my career at Lonmin as a mine geologist, senior mine geologist. Eventually, I spent 10 years there. I ended up being the mineral resource manager for the Lonmin operations. And at that time, I just said, you know, like Piet said, the big corporates are just kidding you. And they became a takeover target for Americans, and they put in this new culture and things changed. And I just said, okay, that's it. And that's when I joined GEMEX. And by the way, GEMEX, a lot of people actually don't know, it's actually standing for Geology, Exploration, Mining, Evaluation, Consulting Services. So we do a bit of everything. I've been here now for over 15 years, and we do everything from exploration, management, core locking, sampling, database, the modeling work, even a bit of mine planning, and of course the mining in production work as well. I like to be at the mines at least once a week if I can.
We were talking about, you know, being on the ground, having exposure to exploration and mining. So I'm going to bring in Karen again, who's, as she acknowledged earlier on, wanted to be on the other side of the table.
Yeah, in terms of the exploration, it was always interesting. I remember when I asked people, oh, so if you work on an exploration project, are you going to become the mine geologist? So it was like, okay, at that point in time, I didn't understand the long process it took to actually get from where a project is an exploration phase up to getting to a mine. And I think in the earlier days, there were no such things as mining permits. It didn't exist. So you didn't just go and drill 5 holes in a 5-hectare piece and created a mine. These were huge areas, and me working in the Highveld coalfield as a junior, it was a lot more complex. So I remember when I went out logging as well, I always had my camera and my binoculars with me because it was good to see birds. And I remember photographing beetles and all sorts of hoekies going out while I was going to log. Also those days, I could actually go and log with shorts and sandals. I didn't have to wear a hard hat. I didn't have to wear steel cap toes, shoes. So that was actually good fun. It was a good time spending out in the field. Nowadays it's a lot hotter because you have to wear closed shoes and all of that. And then that first experience going underground at, it's not that I haven't been underground. I've been underground with, as a student. But actually working underground and being responsible and having to talk to people. I remember Rob Green was my mine captain in one of the areas. And I learned quite a bit from him. Took me to stoneworks, showed me how they go through dikes. And then I had to learn or teach the people because one of the Jaloos always told us in Afrikaans, a rock at a swim. Coal is a layer. So it's a log, it's not a seam. So your dress has got a seam. So that was a direct translation. So we always got it, Cecil. It was a very Afrikaans culture, but we were very strict on nomenclature and what did you call things. So out of that, when you talk to these miners and then you have to explain to them, a dike is not just a dike. There's sills and there's dikes. And there's a difference. But to them, it's just a hard rock. Having discussions on things like grade control, telling people that if it's black, it doesn't necessarily mean it's coal. It could be something else as well. So you better mind where you cut. So those were the sort of fun days and the interesting things. Taking me back to that, coming out from underground, the best thing is always the shower. I think there was a mining engineering lady at Twistdraai long before I was there. And then after a while, I was the first female geologist going underground. And then, I think the fun thing was me getting out of the ladies' change house, which I had all to myself. Coming out there, the guys will actually frighten one another. So they will swear and then tap them on the shoulder and say, "Hey, Karen is achter jou." So those were the sort of fun things or interesting things that happened and you had to sort of grow up and just get over it and get on. Learning curves, I think making mistakes and having to try and explain to management what geology is all about and being told, "Oh, but we need these targets, so you better make it fit." And I'm like, the geological model tells me something else. I can't make it fit. It's not going to work. I can't go and tell you you're going to get better yields than what's in the ground. No, but that's the target. We got to make it. So you better make sure we get there. So starting to think not just about geology, but learning about what mining is about as well. And that's where I came in with the whole thing that I sat in too many discussions where geology got to be blamed for everything. And I always said, geology's got big shoulders. We can carry anything. But it helped understanding where mining came from so you could go and convince them with numbers and figures and prentjies to say, this is the real story. So whether you want something else, it's not going to happen. And I can promise you, yeah, up to today, I've been in mining for a long time. It's still the same story. There's always this discussion that you have to have and the convincing that you have to do to say, well, guys, this is what's in the ground. So we have to make it work.
I think one thing that mining taught us all is to grow a very thick skin. That's the only way to survive there.
I one day told one of my female junior geologists, go, well, I have to say it in Afrikaans, trek jou renosterpakkie aan. So you've got to get a thick skin like a rhino, because the thorns are going to be there and the daggers are going to be there, and you just got to bear it. That's what it's all about.
As Nico mentioned, there was a drilling company that you started in the mid-90s.
It was one of the best things I could have done. You know, nowadays, I think Geological Society or maybe Fossil Fuel Foundation has got courses in drilling techniques. And if you drilled yourself, I always say to junior geologists or somewhere, you don't understand from where you logged a hole now today, what happens in between until you lock the next hole tomorrow. A driller's life is not easy. Things break. Things just happens that you can't explain. So it was very, 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 very tough work, but I was still young and I could do it. But the nice thing about it was that it gave me exposure to coal fields, which you would not have gotten if you worked for a single company. I'm not criticizing, but you said we can be open on this. I've got a problem with people working in companies. And not all. Karen, I don't criticize you. But they are so single-minded and focused on their own mind that they don't understand the industry. They don't see the wider picture. And that's where the frustration comes in as consultants, is to actually tell to the guy, but what you've got is not only what you've got. There's a world out there and you have to market your coal or you have to work. So what it did was it gave me exposure to all the coal fields. And during that time, you actually see what you read later in papers and publications and reports and so on. So somebody asked me, the farm so-and-so, there and there and there, what do you think? I was there. You know, I did some drilling in that area. So it gives you that kind of exposure. But it's really tough work. Drillers, I've got huge respect for drillers in the sense that I understand what happens in between. But in the same time, even now today, a lot of the people that I did work for, which were like the Bobs, like Dave Proctor, that's passed away. So by the way, John Giles also passed away. But Nico, John Giles was known as the poisonous dwarf. He was yeah, about 4 feet high. But he had an attitude and a short humor. Yes, he had no sense of humor. And I did drawing for him and Ronaldo Anthony when they were at BHP Billiton in 1998 up in the Waterberg. And we drilled rather late. We drilled here around about October, November. And during that time of the year, it is actually quite hot in Lepalale, Ellis Ras area. And we were drilling the BHP Billiton projects, and John Giles were so afraid of snakes. So what he wore while logging the holes were his boots up to his knees and the padded with sheepskin in. So I'll ask him, where do you bring this from? He says, my snow boots from the UK, but it works for the snakes. So he was standing in the sun wearing snow boots, logging holes because he was too afraid of snakes. You know, we only got cell phones here end of 94. So you haven't had reception everywhere. And we were drilling there at the Witterkrans. And the farmers were busy harvesting beans. And they've moved my drill machine, but that's the same spot that the farmer actually wanted to load his beans from his combine harvester on. Now my drill is in his way. And they phoned me, but it's a broken signal. And all I could hear is, come help, come help, come help. I thought, oh, shucks, what's happening? One of my guys has got injured or whatever, and I drove there. And the farmer was standing on top of his wagon. And when I stopped there, he was starting to shout at me in Afrikaans. And he said, this damn, now he said it in Afrikaans, this damn Englishman doesn't understand Afrikaans, and I want him to move that drill rig. And he doesn't understand me, but this guy's now furious. I said to him, listen, don't stand on top there. Come talk to me down here. And he had about two or three feet. He said, no, I'm not going to come down. I know you're going to moor me. So I'm standing here. And old Dave Proctor was standing there on the side. He was with eyes so big. And Dave didn't understand one single word of Afrikaans. All he said, was, well, he understood some of the swear words. It's all he understood. And I'm not going to say those swear words here. But those are the kind of things that you deal with farmers. Difficult, very, very difficult farmers. You get, well, on the drilling, even as exploration geologists, in those days, they phoned the office. You go to the office, and the secretary has got messages written down that phone this farmer. Oh. And then you have to hear them going off about your machine in the way and what, and said, well, we had permission, yeah, but not permission for today.
You're saying about the experience of actually doing drilling, so that you actually understand what drillers are all about. So you've been on both sides of the fence. And I think that is actually very, very important. And I think one of the things that we as consultants and contractors out in the field need to be very aware of is just what goes on with a drilling operation, what the guys can do, what they can't do, and what their limitations are. And very, 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 very definitely what they're telling you as opposed to what is the actual truth, because it's sometimes a little bit of both.
I think one thing about geology, and I must touch on the work that Piet said with the drilling, there's a balance. There's drilling and there's mining. And I think the geologist sits in the middle of everything. And it's so important and critical to understand drilling, where it's coming from, the in-between step and the resource work that we do a lot of, and then eventually the actual mining. And a geologist is almost like that connection in between the whole process. So it's so critical. And that's why I was fortunate in my career where I did exploration work, I did underground mining, I did hard rock mining, I did coal mining, I did open cast mining, drag lines, stooping, conventional mining, you know, mechanized mining. And eventually I'm a consultant today, but you need to get that tool set. I think that's quite critical. But yeah, but back to the platinum a bit. You know, coal is a bit, I will almost say, a more relaxed, but you need to have a lot of discipline when it comes to logging and sampling in coal. And like Karen said, coal is, whatever is black, it's not always coal. And whatever is coal is not always good coal. You know, we mine different. And I think that's the most intriguing thing about coal, and that's why I enjoy about coal, is that coal is just not coal. If you take gold or platinum or copper, it's gold or platinum or copper. It's like 99.9% pure, and that's what you've got. If you've got 3 grams per ton of gold or platinum, it's 3 grams per ton, but it's pure platinum. But if you've got coal, it's 10% ash or 20% ash or 30% ash, or it's lean coal or it's anthracite or it's steam coal or it's devolatilized coal or it's rubbish that nobody wants. So, and that's the thing about coal. So, and that all boils down to sampling, which you mentioned. So, you know, today a lot of people still want to save money and they don't want to do down a wireline logging, but you know, it's almost a sin not to use the tools that's available today, because that allows you to see whatever is black is not black, and there's differences in the black. And for people that don't know, in the coal industry, we basically sample everything. So there's nothing left after you've burnt it. And that's why it's so important in the coal industry. Once you've taken a sample, you take it to the lab, it's burnt, it's gone. And you can't take it back. Whatever is left is the bit of material that the lab will keep for a while.
Look, I think two important points about coal exploration that Nico actually touched on while he was chatting just now. Firstly, yes, when you sample coal, the whole lot goes. You cannot cut coal core in half. It doesn't work. So you have to sample the whole thing. Now, these days, obviously, one of the protocols we put in place is that everything is photographed. So you have a clear and high quality photograph of your coal seam. So you can actually go back to that and look at what the coal did look like before you sampled it. One of the reasons, well, the main reason for that is that you can't cut the coal core statistically accurately. And secondly, you need that bulk of material to actually do all the tests you need to do. You've got a plethora of different measurements that all need to be combined so that you can understand what the coal is actually all about. You've got the calorific value, you've got ash content, you've got the moisture, you've got the volatiles, and then you not only will you sample or rather assay for the raw coal, but you also put it more than likely through a wash process of four or five different washes at different densities, and then do the same analysis all over again for each of those washes. So you end up with a huge amount of analytical data.
I want to bring back Piet again, because you've worked, as Karen says, there's the whole layer versus seams, but very thin seams back in the total days, and then thick seams in, you know, Mozambique coal fields.
Well, the very first thing is that your very first hole, you drill down to basement. Doesn't matter what the client says, so you can get your correlations right. Because a lot of problems starts with half drilled, partially drilled holes. You need to know where you are and what. It's really important, because you can sit in zone 8 and you think you're in zone 5 or 6. You know, you really have to drill those holes down so that you can pick up all your zones, so you know where you are. Karen's company Menar is drilled some holes on a project that I did in 2016, and that's in the Riversdale project in Natal. And some of those holes went 300 meters. So you drill for 200 meters dolerites, and then you drill a couple of meters of sandstones, and then you go into your coal seams. So, and those coal seams are thin. So to get about 2 meters in total coal, you drill a 300 meter hole. And if you're not drilling your holes deep enough, and if you don't understand your stratigraphy, you can easily miss the seams, or you can actually drill them short and say, oh, well, there's no coal. You can drill them, you must drill them deep to actually to get to your full sequence.
What I also want to add to Piet's discussion was it's sometimes the most difficult thing is to manage your client's expectations and to understand what their expectations are, and explain to them what is realistic and what they really can get out of a project. Because that whole thing of, no, we're saving money. So number one, we don't drill through to basement, but you still need to be able to tell them exactly where to mine. Number two, not wanting to do full analyses or a full set of analyses. And not understanding that you've got a fresh project, Greenfields project, and you don't actually know what you want to do and which markets you want to address. So if you don't make those analyses now, while you've got the opportunity, you can't go back and fill in the basics. So quite often you'll have somebody say, no, we just want raw qualities, not interested in anything else. Then you've done everything and you 2-3 years later, the same project comes over. Oh, but now we want to wash the coal. But 2 years back, you weren't willing to spend the money to actually do the washabilities, do the special analyses that is required for specific set markets. I'm looking at all these new projects that's rising up, and everybody wants to tender to deliver coal to Sasol, but they've got no idea what are the batches of qualities required to qualify a coal for the Sasol process?
All the tons.
All the tons.
They've got mining permits, but they want to supply to Sasol and Eskom.
Oh, yeah, that's the other one. If you ask on a mining permit, I say, who are you going to sell your coal to? Oh, no, I'm going to sell it to Sasol. And I'm like, okay. Work there, understand the processes. Sasol don't need variable coal. They like Eskom. They want a consistent stream. So you need to understand also, who do you sell your coals to? And I think for the youngsters out there to learn that there is no quick way. We are maybe older, so we are more set in our ways and have learned in time to be disciplined and to spend the time. I think, Bert, you also mentioned about not staying within companies. I think I was fortunate enough that in all the companies that I worked, I was almost, I was exposed to almost all the coal fields in South Africa and then also in Southern Africa. But the Southern Africa came later when I was a consultant working on the Botswana coal fields and also in Eswatini. So you need to be open and you need to understand that there's different sets of data that you need to be able to compare. And if you don't, if you can't go back to first principles when you look at these data sets, you're going to fall out of the bus. And you can't let people tell you how to do your job. You need to be able to be sure enough to tell your client, this is what needs to be done. And if this is not done, I can't sign off on your project. As simple as that. And I think a lot of clients push you into a corner to say, but this is what is there and this is what I'm willing to pay for and you may have to make it work. And I think we all try and bend over backwards sometimes to meet those requirements. But I've learned the hard way as well that you need to stand on your point and say, but this is what is required. And if it doesn't, if it's not that, I can't help you.
I think what happened was the intention of the MRDPA in 2006 when it was enacted was to empower a lot of people to get access to the minerals. And the easiest one to enter was coal because everybody thought that coal starts just outside of Pretoria and it goes all the way to Richards Bay. And then it starts there in Messina and goes all the way down to Maltina. But so there were lots of applications and a lot of expectations. And let's forget the big guys. Let's forget the Shandukas. We know who owned the Shanduka at the time. Forget the BHPs, Anglos. You're dealing with the smaller guys. Some of them were very successful. They were lucky. They were early entrants into the market. So they picked up coal areas or areas that had coal that was saleable. Again, Eskom empowered a lot of them by purchasing some of the coal and gave them a good cash flow. But now you find your late entrants. And those are the guys that you get in the last 5, 6, 7 years coming in. First off, they don't have money. They live all in Pretoria and now they want to come and start a coal mine in Witbank. And when you tell him, guys, it's been mined out. There is nothing left. It's been explored. You can't tell us anything new. There is nothing new. You're not going to discover anything new. They think you're stupid. And now it's a lot of projects that's coming up in KwaZulu-Natal, particularly around the Vryheid area, because anthracite's got such a high price, everybody wants to be there. And then you go and have a look at it, and then they just, for example, next to Falkrans, you say, but there's the coal mine, I can see it from here, so there must be coal here. But what they don't understand of the faulting that takes place in Natal, up to 200, 300 meters fault. When they take you to a river and they show you outcrop, it's black stuff, but it's actually the Pietermaritzburg formation, which sits below the Vryheid formation. So now you tell him, listen, there's no coal. No, but it can't be. There's Falkrans and this is black stuff is in the river. How can you tell me there's no coal? And then you say to him, well, the only way I can prove to you is to drill. Let's take a percussion machine, drill 200 meters. If we don't find coal, then you walk away. And then they don't have the money for that or they don't want to do it. They don't want to risk that. They don't believe you, but that final push just to prove him wrong, they don't want to do because he's paid his million or whatever for environmental guarantee. So those are very, very difficult guys to convince that there's no coal. He doesn't have a project.
I think what I've also seen is the expectations around quality, and that's where something black is black. I mean, you get people I had clients contacting me saying, oh, I've got this project, and it's being sold as anthracite or something similar. And then you start looking at it, and then it's plain devolatilized coal because it's got a 6% volatile, sure, but it also has got a 35 to 45% ash. And to try and convince those people that this is really a dead horse. It's not going to fly. You're not going to mine it ever. But they still insist that you must do some work on that. So it's people not understanding the different coal fields as well. The other thing, as you mentioned, the Freyet Formation or the Klip River coal field. I mean, those are high sulfurs. And then they also try and convince you, but, oh, this is anthracite. But then they don't realize the volatiles is very variable there. So if you're not in the low volatile, there's no ways it's going to make it. They try and mine a 13, 14% volatile and sell it off as anthracite. It just doesn't work. So those are the things that people need to realize and need to understand. And it's difficult for the clients to actually understand that.
Yeah, I think the perception is out there that any piece of coal, which is a project in the beginning, will become a mine. And I think that's a big problem in the industry. Taking into account all the variables down to the mining, and Sufisi, we were up there about that, you know, thin seams and thick seams. You know, we've got thick seams here in Tala and Matlas. You can drive a bus underground. And then Zach and Natal, we mined 80 centimeters of coal. It's different market, it's different coal. But people, the perception is we're going to get this permit and make a mine. But the economics of this whole thing, and it's not only about seam thickness, Karen, like you mentioned, about the qualities. There's so many things. It's about strip ratio, it's about roof conditions, about floor conditions, about contamination, the type of machinery. And that's where the big money starts. And you know, if you take an bit, yeah, people don't have always money to pay us for our job, but that's so critical. If you look at what's the real cost of establishing a mine and the capital that's needed, the geology part is it's a drop in the glass. You know, it's so little. But then the perception is out there, we're going to put in a little bit of money, but the variables, and that's where I think, again, what I mentioned earlier on, where the geologists play such a big role, is to tell the client about this has got economic potential or not. And you actually the first filter. Yes, we can carry on drilling because there's a good chance this might become a mine. Or no, you're going to waste your money, walk away, don't drill anymore. And there's unfortunately, I think there's some geologists out there that's not as responsible.
On that, we've segued now into lessons and what the youngsters can learn. I want to now focus on that a bit.
I think the biggest thing that youngsters need to learn if they specifically want to get into the coal industry is the complexity of it. And we've all touched on that in terms of the amount of data that is generated. It tends to make things look simple because you are dealing with flat tabular ore bodies, for want of a better word, and it all looks so simple. But once you start working on it and you start getting involved in analyzing not just the physical model, but the quality model as well, that there is a whole range, well, there's a whole world of complexity that you need to understand. And if you can't get your head around that, then you're actually not going to really be that effective in the coal industry. So I think that's the main thing, is that youngsters coming into coal really need to understand just how complex the whole process can be.
I've been accused many times of being negative, but I see myself as realistic, so I'm not negative. But we see it. I've had a call again today. There's a total oversupply of geologists, coal geologists, juniors in the coal industry. Because a lot of them actually lost their jobs, which is very sad. Then there are a big complement of guys that got packages from Anglo-American 50 and above that's also looking for work. And we know those guys by the name because we dealt with them over the years. There's a big oversupply of coal geologists, and those poor guys do not find work. We've got now geologists with MSCs doing grade control in pits because there's nothing else, and they actually work for a starter, maybe just less than a starter package, just to find work. So if you ask me, and it's actually the whole mining industry, is there still place for geologists? Yes, there is a place for geologists. But the universities, when I was an honor student, we were only 4 in a class. Now the classes are pumping still out 40 geologists a year. Where are those guys going to find work? There's a massive move away from in-house training to using consultants to train like Bob. So it is sad, but I don't think there's space anymore for juniors coming out of university working in the coal industry. And that's my negative view. But in the same time, I would not tell my kids to go and study geology, metallurgy, or mining engineering. I would not tell them to do that. Rock engineering, yes, go and do some rock engineering course because there will be a demand for that. And because of it's a safety thing. A lot of mines still needs rock engineers. But the other mainstream mining careers, honestly, sorry, I don't see a future.
On that, I want to maybe see if there's a positive spin on this. Back to the potential comment.
Well, I think one of the experiences, apart from the South African experience, I was quite deeply involved in the Swaziland side, and I had 3 different clients on that side. And at some point, the mining board, they allocated a whole bunch of prospecting rights to various people, with the expectation that they will create coal mines and develop the coal mines there. They're close to ports, in terms of they believe they can just truck the coal out to Mozambique, and they're close to Richards Bay. But all of that relies on using external transport sources. And what we're seeing there, even there, I think I've started there in COVID, and of all those projects, there's one that's really taken hold and is actually being developed and is currently busy going underground. And I think the same goes to, as you say, in the South African context, there are some of the companies that's developed or being developing new projects. But a lot of those projects are really difficult. And saying that, if you take in junior geologists, it takes time to train them up to be able to do what you require them to do. And if you don't do that in-house, I think the gap is getting too big. All the people working in coal is like 40 plus, 50 plus, and you've got a couple of youngsters, but the gap in between is just far too big. I've also been helping and coaching a couple of students out of varsity, helping them with projects. I sit on the advisory board at the University of Stellenbosch. I see those graduates finishing. We don't actually see those Stellenbosch graduates going into mining houses. They all go into environmental geology. They go into other consultancy. They go into data science, but not the pure mine geology that we got to know. And I think that is the sort of risk that's out there. I work for Menard now, and Wislat has got a very broad and outlook that there is still a place for coal in our industry, and what they've shown and what they've seen is we can't just switch from coal into renewables. It's just not going to work. We don't have the finances for that, and you'll always need that base load from coal. The fact is just that the economics have changed, and to make the coal work, it's going to cost a lot more money than it did 30 or 40 years ago. So I think that's the reality, that there might still be resources, but it's going to be slow mining. It's going to be difficult mining. The days where, gosh, I remember at Sasol we had the million tons shifts a month. I mean, it just doesn't happen anymore. It can't. Those guys, the progress is just so much smaller. I mean, you now mine some of these mines, you mine 200 meters and you're into a dike. Then you've got to go through a 3 meter or a 6 meter dike to get to the other side to just mine another 300 or 400 meters and then you're against the next dike. So cost implications are just so much more different. It's more difficult.
I can add a good story about Botswana. I've actually done quite a fair bit on coal in Botswana. And the thing is, like Piet said, in Botswana, the numbers are billions, not millions. It's huge resource areas. There's a lot of coal in Botswana. A lot of the coal is deeper, but there's some quite thick coal seams. The biggest drawback is, first of all, the qualities. It's not as good as what we known to have in South Africa. So it's a bit lower CVs, higher ash coal. And the biggest problem that Botswana has is access to ports and markets. But being said that there's 2.5 coal mines in Botswana at the moment that I know of. And then one of my clients, Martla, they're opening up a coal mine as well, which is in the Mamabula coal field. But Yindal is also in the Mamabula coal field, also opening up the fourth mine. So things are really, the momentum is getting there. But the big thing is how these mines going to, because they don't have an Eskom or an export market as we've got in South Africa, you have to look at it differently in terms of marketing your coal. You have to look at different products. One opportunity is the closest in the Northwest province. For example, the cement factories that's there. It's a bit closer than Mpumalanga. But also what Yindal did is they signed agreements with the Botswana Power Corporation whereby they would put up 300 megawatt units to generate electricity. So it's selling the electricity, not selling the coal. It's easier to move electricity through a line than to put coal on a truck or a train and transport it somewhere else. So I think that opportunity, Botswana government has realized that. And the other thing is with these other big projects, there's big scopes and there are companies that I know of that's got big resource base in Botswana. And they are looking at putting type of Sasol industries where you can manufacture diesel is a big problem in Africa. You can manufacture diesel from coal. We know we've got a big electricity crisis in all southern Africa. You can export electricity. So I think those projects will eventually, because the big thing is if you don't have a market or you can show that you can sell your coal, you don't have a reserve. You only got a resource. So as long as you don't have a reserve, people can't get mining rights in Botswana. But being creative in what are you going to sell, not the coal, you sell electricity, you sell diesel, you can get a mining right. The other thing I want to touch on just in this, on the training side, and it's back to the big mines, small mines, the culture we grew up where we had big corporates, and big corporates gave bursaries and big corporates gave people opportunities. There were no small miners around when we were young. Today it's different. There's a 2 or 3 big miners, and then there's thousands and hundreds of junior miners out there. And junior miners operate with contractors and consultants. And unfortunately, because of that model, they don't invest in people. There's not a hierarchy of a senior geologist training and junior geologist. We give bursaries, we support people, we support training. And the corporates out there, they still do it, some more than others, but that's not enough. And the junior miners and the mid-tier miners are the people that should actually invest in people and geologists. And with bursaries and programs out there, and I would really strongly, I hope they listen, because that's a big shortfall in our industry. But there need to be dedicated people out there that's either been paid from the state in terms of training, that actually train people up, or the junior guys need to come on board and support not only geologists, technical people. We're talking about surveyors, geologists, rock engineers, all those skills, which is really much needed going forward, be it in coal or any other industry.
The other thing I'd appeal to you, if you're not already doing, is getting involved in the GSSA mentoring program, which we started a few years ago. I do know you mentor various people informally and formally, but if you can add a bit more of those, that would be great, so that we do develop the next generation of coal legends such as yourselves. Before we wrap up, just I want to just go around, and I'll start with Bob. Firstly, if there's anything else you'd like to add, but also if you were younger, you, what would you have done differently?
Would I have done it differently? No, I don't think so. I think I'm very happy with the way my particular my professional course has taken, and I find coal a fascinating subject. As soon as I get my hands on a new project, I'm all fired up and ready to go and tackle it. Physical models, quality models, drilling, everything that goes with it. So I actually find coal a lot more exciting than base metals.
One thing I want to tell just for the younger people out there, and I'm the youngest of this team, but when we grew up and actually started to work, we didn't have internet, cell phones, Google Earth, electronic maps. We had used scale rulers, pencil sharpeners, no GPSs. When I was at Zach years ago, to stake out 2 or 3 borehole in a day, it took us a day. You had to go out with a surveyor, and he dropped you in the field. We had to use two-way radios to communicate. He had to go and set up on the top of a hill somewhere, and you had to find your way more or less where you thought the borehole would be, and put a staff up with reflectors, and he will sight you from the hill and radio back and did his calculations and said, no, you have to go 300 meters west. And then you had to walk through the bush, you think 300 meters, up to where he can see you again, and you put the staff up and he takes the sighting and do the calculations. And then you were 50 meters south and you had to move again, you know, and that was difficult. And one thing I can tell people is get your hands dirty, but you also got technology today. To go out today and sight a bottle, we sight 20 bottles in an hour. It's easy. You've got a GPS. I would never done anything else in my career. I had the opportunity to work underground every day when I was on the platinum mines. I loved to go underground, and that's something. You know, you can't be a geologist if you sit in an office with fancy shoes on every day. The best saying I had, and I will end with this, is one of, I think it was Frank Vermaak. He's also now passed away a long time ago. Very experienced geologist. And he once told me the best geologist is the geologist that have seen the most rocks. And that's really the point. If it's underground or in a drill core, or in an outcrop, or even YouTube. By the way, if the geology people don't, there's a lot of good YouTube videos out there from professors in geology that teaches people geology. So, you know, build up your skills, get your experience, get your hands dirty, but see as much rocks as you can.
I would not prefer a different life. I really had an exciting life. I really saw the world through, and being paid for it through due diligence work, and I did a lot of work up in Africa. So it was, I really had a good career. It's just no, there's no remorse anyway. I fully agree with Nico. The biggest thing that gives a consultant or a geologist the head start is to, and what Karen also said earlier, is get involved in the mining side of things as well. You can't work on a computer screen and think you know everything. Out of my experience and my consultancy, the thing that makes me very marketable is the fact that I worked on mines, but I understand the connection between the exploration borehole and the underground or open pit cut. that I was involved in planning. I can do project management, all of those things. Train yourself. Don't just stick to geology. Get involved. Just as a conclusion, I would like to read just a quick article that came out the 10th of February. It was a research study done by CNBC. It says U.S. exports of coal have been rising steadily to satisfy growing global demand for the world's dirtiest fossil fuel, even though its domestic consumption has decreased. The global shift away from coal remains challenging, largely driven by rising demand in Asia, even as Europe and the U.S. see significant decline in coal consumption. The world won't be able to release its grip on coal anytime soon. President Trump quoted, "Nothing can destroy coal, not the weather, not the bomb." U.S. coal exports have been rising steadily to satisfy growing global demand for the world's dirtiest fossil fuel. On top of that, world coal consumption reached a new record high in nearly 2.175 gigawatts in 2024. I'm absolutely pro-nuclear, that's a future in energy. But what it's actually done is it says the global shift away from coal remains challenging, and that nobody can actually really get rid of it. And which is the main culprits? China. China recently reported its coal imports surged 14.4% to a record high in 2024, amounting to 542 million metric tons compared to 474 tons the year before. That's 2023. The world's largest economy is also the largest coal consumer globally. So there's internationally, this whole thing of moving away to clean energy is not going to work. The hydropower is not working. Nothing is actually working but coal.
The world is not going to move away from coal. We've learned that now. And we've seen that. I think for the youngsters out there, go and diversify as fast as you can. Learn a lot about the businesses. Do extra courses. Speak to different people. It's not just about geology. It's about knowing where you can fit in and where you can make a difference. And I think that's where you can start developing your career. I mean, when I started, I finished my honors and I needed to go and find a job, and there weren't jobs available at that point in time. And I went on and I did my master's, and eventually I found a job. So if you can find something that you can do, add value, I think the new things in coal should be, how do we get cleaner coal, study cleaner coal technologies where you can apply yourself. I believe you will find a job, but you will need to go and specialize and do something different to define you above somebody else. Yes, we can't just get into consulting. You need knowledge to be able to consult. And that's sort of the difficult part of finishing your degree and having to find a job. I'm looking at my son at the moment. Everywhere he applies, I don't have experience. I need experience, at least just a year's experience. But where do you find that year's experience? Go shadow as far as you can. Go out there, talk to people, spend time with people. I know it takes time to get trained up, and I know, but it takes effort, and you need to go and find those efforts. There's a lot of free training things available. If you look at the GSSI website, there's podcasts, there's people that you can talk to, mentoring. I mean, find a coach, somebody that you can talk to that you can say, how do I do this? When do I do this? Who can I talk to if I want to know something else? And I think that's the message I want to bring home to our youngsters. Find that connection and see how you can make that work for you. And yeah, coal is going to be with us a very long time.
Thank you to our esteemed guests, Nico Denner, Piet Meyer, Karen van Dieventer, Bob Heatherly, for sharing some insights around the journey, and more importantly, how the youngsters can navigate the industry and what some of the potential is.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.